These two did that for science. Luther, of course, much earlier, does it for religion, does it for specifically Christianity, and starts and tears apart the Catholic Church as a result. Tears apart, I should say, Western Christendom. And he didn't tear apart the church, but he tore an enormous amount of people out of the church. And the reason is because at a critical point in his life, instead of choosing to be chaste, instead of choosing to follow the moral law, he claimed that you could sin boldly, but believe more boldly. The moral law didn't apply to us. We were free from it because all of our works are just sort of tattered rags in the presence of God. And that we don't have a free will anyway. And yes, there are in the Catholic camp sometimes exaggerations or misrepresentations of things that Luther said or did. But this is in Luther's own words. I'm paraphrasing those words now. But look it up yourself. It's in the Enslaved Will. Jones quotes it verbatim. he proposes the will as a saddle horse. And if God is seated on the saddle horse, the will cannot help but go where God wants it to go and do good. If the devil is seated on the saddle horse, then the will will go where the devil wants it to go and cannot help but do evil. So Luther specifically preached against the freedom of the will, specifically. And when he specifically preached against the freedom of the will, he specifically cited himself as an example of not having a free will, because every time he tried to be good, he found that he could only be bad. So therefore, there's no free will. He actually says it in about that many words in one of his sermons. He just completely dismisses the idea of a free will. And Jones shows by layering the doctrine of Luther on top of the biography. By the way, that was the year that he married Catherine von Bora, a former nun. Luther basically acted as something of a pimp, lining up ex-nuns who had solemn vows. These are Cistercian nuns who had solemn vows with ex-priests who, in many cases, had solemn vows, or either that or they were diocesan priests. Now, the German church was at that time notoriously lax, and this is one of the things that led to the Reformation. There was not a resistance against Luther because many of the priests were morally compromised. They themselves weren't following the moral law, so how could they resist this man who was defecting from the church? So many of them went along with it, and Luther knew that if he pimped these nuns to them and got them to get married, that would seal the deal. And that's exactly what happened. Because once they were in those relationships, they were sort of trapped. And some of them actually acknowledged it explicitly. And Jones documents this. Okay, so now I really want to talk about the beauty of chastity. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to kind of do some skipping around here. You're listening to Reconquest on the Crusade Premium Channel, part of the Veritas Radio Network. This is episode number 283. It is called How Beautiful is the Chaste Generation. I want to cut to the chase, or cut to the chaste, right now by pointing out that in the writings of Joseph Pieper, who, by the way, is cited by Jones. So reading Jones's book, I came across a citation from Pieper. I was like, oh, I know that book. I've got it. So we one of the sisters found it where we had it. I want to get to where Pieper describes the beauties of chastity. Now, unchastity is not the worst sin. It's certainly not the only sin. Even if what Our Lady of Fatima said is true, and I believe it to be true because it comes from Our Lady, it's a proved revelation that most people go to hell because of sins of the flesh, that still doesn't make unchastity the worst sin. It simply means it's the most common, right? So the example I like to give is if more people die of the flu than die of Ebola, right? But which is the worst disease? Well, Ebola is. I mean, when you get Ebola, you're gone, right? Boom. You're not going to survive that, and it's a hideous, horrible, disgusting death. Or yellow fever, painful, horrible, humiliating, disgusting, slow, painful, awful death. But many more people die of the flu than of that. And the flu is kind of this, well, I guess you could call it inglorious, but it's not as horrific a death. And objectively, it's not as bad of a disease because a lot of people get the flu and only a certain amount of them die from it every year, right? So one's more common, but it kills more, but it's not as bad in itself, right? So there are sins like blasphemy, right, or sacrilege, or unbelief, which are actually worse than sins against chastity. They're worse. Objectively, in themselves, they are much worse. Unchastity, sins against chastity gets, sins against the sixth and ninth commandment get more people into hell. So Dante, you know, shows one of the first places you run into in the Inferno is people who committed sins against chastity. Well, that's not the worst part of hell. It's kind of near the top. But notice, it's still hell, okay? So we're not letting people off for those sins. So it's not the worst sin, it's not the only sin, and it's not the thing that we should be mostly preoccupied with. But the world is preoccupied with it, so we do need to address it. So the beauty, let me say some things quoting Pieper about the beauty of temperance and its particular part, or the part of temperance, which is called chastity. He uses the Latin names for the virtues. Temperantia, in the strict sense and ultimate sense, is not realization of the good. Discipline, moderation, chastity do not in themselves constitute the perfection of man. By preserving and defending order in man himself, temperantia, that's temperance again, creates the indispensable prerequisite for both the realization of actual good and the actual movement of man towards his goal. Without it, the stream of the innermost human will to be would overflow destructively beyond all bounds. Yet it would lose its direction and never reach the sea of perfection. Not yet. I put in the word yet. It would lose its direction and never reach the sea of perfection. Yet, temperantia is not itself the stream, but it is the shore, the banks, from whose solidity the stream receives the gift of straight, unhindered course of force, descent, and velocity. So here he's showing if our will to be, the stream of our life going towards its consummation, towards its perfection, if that can be envisioned as a stream, then chastity is the banks. It directs it. It gives it force. It gives it current. It gives it velocity, but it gives it restraint, right? So that it can actually reach its goal. A very good figure of speech, I believe. Now, he speaks in terms of, let me find, there's a passage in here where he talks about the beauty of chastity. Unchaste lust has the tendency to relate the whole complex of the sensual world, and particularly of sensual beauty, to sexual pleasure exclusively. Therefore, only a chaste sensuality. Now, when he says sensuality, he's not speaking of something that is inherently unchaste. He's speaking of sensuality is, you know, the experience of things of the senses, right? Of the eyes, ears, etc. So when we say sensual, we usually have a negative connotation to that. He's not speaking that way. Therefore, only a chaste sensuality can realize the specifically human faculty of perceiving sensual beauty, such as that of the human body, as beauty, and to enjoy it for its own sake, for the sensual appropriateness, undeterred. That is to say, for its sensual appropriateness, undeterred and unsullied by the self-centered will to pleasure. It has been said that only the pure of heart can laugh freely and liberatingly. It is no less true that only those who look at the world with pure eyes can experience its beauty. So this fits in with what he's been arguing all throughout, that is that unchastity situates us in ourselves in such a way that all we see is the objects of our lust. Whereas the chaste man, or to the chaste woman, sees reality as it is. And this is in St. Thomas. Pieper's not making this up. This is in St. Thomas. The unchaste man looks at the world, as it were, through jaundiced eyes. The unchaste man sees only the objects of his impure desires. Whereas the chaste man, having those banks directing his river properly, is disciplined in such a way that he actually sees reality as it is. This is the very opposite of the way that the world, and I mean the world in that pejorative sense that is given in the Gospel of St. John, this is the very opposite of the way that the world perceives chastity. They think of chastity as slavery and unchastity as liberation. They think of chastity as this sort of wholehearted embrace of vitality and goodness. And they see chastity as this cramped, niggardly, pusillanimous, you know, hiding from the world, enclosing one in oneself, right? The very opposite is true, because the chaste person can look with a clean eye at what's around him and perceive reality as it is, whereas the unchaste doesn't have that, because all he sees is the objects of his desires. And this explains so much of modern art. Why is it ugly as hell? Why is it so impure? Why is it so disgusting? Because they can't perceive beauty, because they can't perceive reality. They can't perceive order, because they are disordered. Here's Pieper. So, without a direct, innocent, and selfless vision of reality, there can be no interior order of the moral person and no honest moral decision.